We weren't.
Development Committee on Tuesday, March 28th, 2017. And members, today we do have two bills scheduled for public hearings that relate to affordability and student loan debt. And we also have two work sessions, so we get to vote today. One is on open educational resources, and one is on cultural competency. For the audience and for the committee, I am planning on taking these bills in the order that accommodates the chief sponsor schedules. We're still a little bit up in the air on that. People are testifying all over the place. And so this is just a very exciting time to be down here in your state capitol. But for now, we're going to start by working down the agenda in the order that was publicly posted. And I ask for your flexibility as we go. So, okay, we'll begin with inviting Reps Malmstrom and Hernandez up. Oops, wait a minute, is Hernandez here? He is. Okay. Hernandez up to join us for discussion of the status of nursing faculty in Oregon. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2862. Laura, would you please provide the committee with a brief summary?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2862 would appropriate $350,000 from the general fund to be allocated to nursing faculty loan repayment program.
Welcome.
Hello. Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonso Leon, colleagues, it's great to be in front of you all. I bet this is a fun committee to be in. For the record, my name is...
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Diego Hernandez. I'm a state representative for House District 47, East Portland. So I'm here to talk to you about a loan forgiveness program. As you all probably already know, because you're amazing people, nursing comprises the largest segment of the healthcare workforce in Oregon, but also in the United States and at large. In Oregon, we have a supply shortfall. I'll say that again. In Oregon, we have a supply shortfall for qualified registered nurses. As Oregon's population grows, so will the demand. A 2016 report from the Oregon Center of Nursing indicates we can expect a considerable shortage of approximately 6,000 nurses by 2025. So the solution is to increase the capacity of nursing programs to produce new graduates able to enter the workforce to meet this much-needed demand. However, one of the biggest obstacles in order to increase this capacity is the lack of nurse faculty. As some of you may know, nurse practitioners make more than the educators themselves, so creating an incentive for more nurses to go into the education field to prepare and train and teach new nurses is really critical. So to put it simply, we have an insufficient number of nurse faculty, and in order to solve this issue, we want to increase the capacity of nursing programs to produce more qualified nurses. In 2009, the Oregon legislator created the Nurse Faculty Loan Repayment Program. This incentive program has been pivotal in retaining these educators and is a tool that 15 other states has been using to meet the shortfall. It received a one-time allocation of $200,000, and seven nurse faculty members received funding to help offset those costs. HB 2862 would allocate $350,000 for the Faculty Loan Repayment Program and provides funding for approximately 10 more faculty. Colleagues, this legislation represents a critical continuation of this program that remains an important tool for recruiting the educators required to keep the pace of the rising need for qualified nurses in Oregon. I urge your support for House Bill 2862, and thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Reardon and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Sherry Malmstrom from House District 27. I represent Beaverton in parts of Southwest Portland, and I have been a registered nurse since 1981. I'm speaking before you today to ask you to please support HB 2862, this bill that funds the Nurse Faculty Loan Repayment Program. We need to fund this program now more than ever. The Oregon Center for Nursing found that in 2016, the demand for active RNs will increase by 1.9% every year from now to 2025. I recently retired from an active career as a public health nurse, and I worry that there are not enough nurses coming in behind me to meet the increasing demands. A recent study from the Oregon Center of Nursing found that 37% of qualified nursing program applicants are excluded from Oregon's undergraduate programs because of an insufficient amount of nursing faculty. Faculty shortages of schools of nursing across the country are limiting student capacity at a time when we need the nursing capacity to grow. Budget constraints, an aging faculty, and increasing job competition from clinical sites have all contributed to this emerging crisis. Now, I'm going to give you some general figures so you can kind of see how this works as far as, you know, motivations and to become a nurse educator. And I'm using these statistics from the Oregon Center of Nursing. A typical nurse practitioner, this is average, makes about $91,310 a year. The average salary for a registered nurse is $81,500, but can go up dramatically from extra shifts, specialty care, etc. Now, compare that to the average nursing instructor who has to have a master's degree, who on the average is making $73,633. That's a minimum of at least $8,000 a year less, but probably more given the opportunities that other nurses have to make additional money. So why would an experienced nurse want to leave their practice, take on a large chunk of debt to become a nurse educator? Many of them want to, but they can't make it make sense financially. So that's why we need more programs like the Nurse Faculty Loan Repayment Program to encourage these passionate people to become teachers. The National League for Nursing found that one quarter of all educators are leaning toward leaving their job due to low compensation and one half are likely to retire by 2025. That's only 8 years from now. Half of them are going to be gone. The pay gap between RNs and educators, as well as the increase in needed education, remain a huge hurdle to gain and keep nurse faculty. House Bill 2862 will provide funding for approximately 10 more teachers who can train the next generations of nurses in Oregon. It will provide incentives to nurses interested in becoming educators. With more faculty at our institutions training nurses, we can begin to address the nursing shortfall. I'm getting older. And guess what? So are you. And we're all going to need nursing care at some point in our lives. So let's make sure we have the teachers in place to train these nurses that are going to take care of us. We're asking you to send this House Bill 2862 to Ways and Means for further consideration. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel, or are you going to save the hard ones for other people? Refresh you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming and testifying and bringing this before us. And my question's not very hard, so don't worry. Relax. So I'm just trying to understand the program. Where the $350,000 goes. Does it go to pay nurse faculty, or does it help to repay the loans for getting your master's degree?
It's a loan repayment program.
Okay. So and how long do follow up?
Oh, please.
Thank you. So how long does it take to get your master's once you've had your baccalaureate in nursing? Is it 1 year, 2 years, or?
Typically 2 years. People can, you know, drag it out a little longer, right. But, yeah, that's typically can do it
okay.
2 years.
Thank you.
And I just have one question. How many, we have 10 nurse educators would benefit from this, and then how many nurses do you think that would help with? How many nurses would be taught and make it through the system as a result of this sort of thing? Any number per year, anything like that? I just don't know how many nurses are helped by a teacher.
I don't have exact figures for that. I'm sure I can get that to the committee.
Maybe somebody in the audience would work on that one.
Well, yeah. Okay. I can tell you that typically in a clinical rotation, which is what they need the most as nurses to do clinicals with students, they'll have, you know, maybe 8 or 10 students in a group, something like that. Okay. So.
All right. Well, this is an issue that I'm personally very interested in. I think other members are as well. So thank you for testifying today. Oh, I'm sorry.
Johnson.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you guys being here. A couple of questions, please. Are we talking about a one-time appropriation, one biennium? for 10 nurses, is that correct? Or will it be is this an ongoing biennium after biennium appropriation?
Right. Yes, I mean, it's a one-time thing for this group of teachers. But it's an ongoing...
Does the bill reflect that? Is it an ongoing appropriation that's going to be made? Or is this just a one-time shot and instructors? That's my question.
Okay. It'll fund the 10. Are you asking if each year it will be the same?
Is this just
thing?
For the next biennium? We do it one and done for 10 teachers. Is that correct?
Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, if you look at the language under Section 1, mm-hmm. It says for the biennium beginning July 1st to 2017.
Okay, so we're talking 10 instructors then. Okay.
Right. That's correct.
Is this loan repayment only for costs associated with getting your master's so that you can become an instructor, or would it become for the sum total of somebody if they want to enter as a freshman student, go all the way through, get your BA or BS, I guess, in this case, and then go on? Or you just
no, this is just for master's
just
prepared,
for master's.
Yeah.
Okay. Follow-up?
Oh, okay.
So you mentioned the costs, or well, the salary pay, if you will, the differences between nursing hourly rate and so forth, and then you've got what the nursing program pays. This doesn't change the salary level at all. It doesn't change the compensation.
No.
So you're assuming then, I guess, that just simply not having debt as a means as that you would incur getting your extra
right.
certification would be enough to allow folks to stay in the profession, even though they're still going to have that pay inequity, which we just talked
right.
about on the floor, correct?
There's still the pay inequity, but the first barrier that we have to get through is not having them to come out with a giant debt, because that's going to just affect their personal budgets that much.
One final follow-up.
Yep.
Have you consulted with the programs that are doing this now in terms of offering masters for nursing degrees and gotten their input? Colleges that are, providing
mm-hmm.
training. You have?
No. Can you rephrase the question?
Have you had input from the institutions that are providing the degrees, the masters, it'd be the, whatever it takes to be qualified
yeah.
as a teacher? And or did they submit testimony? In favor, support, I haven't...
We have other testimony about this bill coming.
We didn't talk to
yeah.
them. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Jen Baker and Cheryl Caddy. Anyway, Mike. Welcome.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association here today in support of House Bill 2862, which, as you just heard, would allocate $350,000 to the Nurse Faculty Loan Repayment Program. It is a one-time allocation, and this recommendation is coming to you from a robust work group that includes nurse educators, institution, administration, direct care nurses, and the Oregon Nurses Association that's been working together for over 2 years to compile recommendations on the best way to grow our nursing workforce. And looking at the challenges that not only Oregon has, but nationally that we have in recruiting and retaining nurses as educators, this work group came up with a set of recommendations, one legislative request for you this session, and it's to fund the nurse faculty loan repayment program that was created in 2009. Other recommendations that came out of this group were for a campaign to increase awareness of this issue and interest, tuition reimbursement for students as well as scholarships, faculty development of mentorship programs, and practice and education partnerships. So ONA is dedicated to working with our nursing partners and colleagues, as well as healthcare employers for long-term solutions on this. You will see testimony from OHSU, a coalition letter that has hospitals, care providers, as well as educational institutions all in support of this program, and a letter from a former recipient of the program as well.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony today on the behalf of House Bill 2862. I'm Cheryl Caddy. I'm the nurse administrator and nursing faculty at Lynn Benton Community College in Albany. I'm also a member of ONA as well as the Oregon State Bar. You've heard the results from the fabulous and informative work from the OCN on workforce needs for both the need for nurses in the future, and also OCN has done a lot of work about the nurse education faculty workforce. And I can only echo this information and speak to you today from my own experience. And along those lines, I do want to just add a little information to our the previous people providing testimony. One is the statement of the average pay for faculty in the range of $71,000 per year. I would like to just point out that in the community college system, starting wages for nursing faculty are in the neighborhood of anywhere, depending on where you are in the state, from $45,000 to about $58,000. So that is even a larger disparity in pay than what you would see in the university setting. Also, there was a question about how many nurses or students would 10 faculty, how many would they that serve? Our faculty at Lynn Benton Community College, we have 10 full-time faculty. We graduate about 48 new nurses every year. So that would give you an idea, at least from that perspective, of how many nurses that could impact, which could be quite a few over a period of time. So nurses contemplating entering the field of nursing education must grapple with a significant wage disparity, which you have heard about. When considering the opportunities available to nurses with advanced degrees, the cost of obtaining an advanced degree, and the return on that investment, nursing education, quite frankly, is a losing proposition. The cost is a significant barrier to entering a satisfying and much-needed career path. Compensation disparity in light of the required educational needs associated with becoming a nurse educator makes recruitment difficult. Nurses interested in advanced degrees can pursue a more lucrative career as a nurse practitioner or remain within a healthcare system where they would have opportunities for a promotion that would be associated with higher pay or wage differentials associated with advanced education. Many healthcare systems offer tuition reimbursement for their employees on top of their professional development funds that nurses use to help maintain and expand their skill set. In my college setting, we wish we did a wage differential for advanced education, and we don't receive tuition reimbursement. That expectation of having a master's degree to teach is an expectation of the job. While we do receive professional development funds, as staff nurses do, those funds are not enough to both pay for the professional development that we need to maintain and expand our skill set as nurses and as educators, and also pay for tuition. Nurse educators are highly sought after. At Lynn Benton Community College, we have an increasingly difficult time in recruiting and retaining qualified faculty. The lack of faculty is a significant barrier to the ability to expand and sometimes maintain the current number of students that we have. The need for nurses in Oregon is growing, as you've heard, but not only just for staff nurses, but also that pipeline for nurse practitioners. And we're seeing a significant rise in the number of employers that are coming to our campus to recruit our students into their facilities. This year, we have about 10 that have been coming to campus. In years past, we've not had employers at all. But this is just a good reflection of the need for nurses in the future. But to meet this need for nurses, we need to be able to educate them. And to be able to do that, we need nursing faculty to enter and remain in the field. House Bill 2862 will help alleviate one tremendous barrier to nurses becoming educators, and that's the cost of education. The need to receive a monetary return on their educational dollar would be significantly reduced by people who are participating in this program. Nursing education is an extremely satisfying career that can positively impact the practice of nursing for generations. But the cost is high, the workload is high, and the compensation is low. This bill would will assist people making a career choice to come into nursing education. In the next few years, as the need for nurses increases, and including primary care providers, the number of nurse educators decreases through retirement and people just leaving nursing education for a more lucrative career. Our state needs to find some ways to help out with the recruitment and retention of trained nursing faculty. Reinvesting in this program to help with offsetting the cost of education for qualified faculty would go a long way towards this. So I ask you to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Question to this panel.
Thank you both for being here. Two questions, I guess. What's the process? What would be the process for determining where these beneficiaries would be deployed, or what programs they would be attached to? Is there anything in view, or just kind of first come, first serve? Did your work group talk about that?
Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, the loan repayment is administered through the Student Assistance Commission. So in 2009, when this program was funded for the first and only time, they pulled together a work group or a rules advisory committee that set a criteria. Part of the criteria was, of course, that they be employed by an Oregon institution and be a member of nurse faculty. There were other factors that they used to weigh the decision-making process, and then the repayment was administered that way. The current language and statute around the program would require that that group come back together to make those decisions, but it doesn't set the criteria in statute.
Okay. And then one follow-up for you. You mentioned on multiple occasions, I think, the compensation is low. And it really does seem that that's the crux of the matter, isn't it, in terms of being able to not just attract but retain folks in that capacity. When if you're going to get your go another 2 years, you're practically an L, you're getting your nurse practitioner or a PA, which are obviously going to be much more lucrative than, a salary level faculty position at community college, right?
That would be correct. However, there is a lot of benefit to being a nurse faculty, and that is that ability to truly impact nursing practice for generations, and it's very gratifying to help students, help them learn how to become a nurse, how to care for people safely, correctly, how to advocate for patients. We need qualified people to continue to do this. Most times people are drawn to education, it's not because of the money. We try to find other ways to help compensate for that. But retention is an issue, and pay is a tremendous part of that. If we can offset some of that loss through having to pay out for that education, that's hugely beneficial for these people. Many of our faculty are obviously employed by Lynn Benton Community College, working as nursing faculty while they're working on their master's degree as well, so that they can meet the requirements that they need for their position. And it's a special kind of people, I think, that come to nursing education for a variety of reasons. It won't be all about money, but we should encourage them to continue. I do know of others, of staff nurses that I've worked with in the past that do have their master's in nursing education, but will not make that jump to the academic setting because of the low pay, loss of clinical contact with patients.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. One or two questions. I think it's a huge issue. It has been for a long time, and so thank you for all the work that your work group did. Just trying to get a feel for, is retaining 10 teachers, is that going to help? Is that going to bend the curve? So just roughly how many nurse educators do we have in the state, and how many do we need, and, will this make a difference?
Well, that's a difficult question. In the report from the OCN in 2014, I think they said that there were 720 nurse educators at the time. And I believe that also included part-time faculty as well. How many is that going to need? Are we going to need in the future? That's going to depend on the number of nurses that we actually have to have. Right now, the average age for nurse faculty is 56. So we are looking at a lot of people retiring in the few years. And that number actually is from 3 years ago. So that average is up a little bit. Everybody's marching a little closer to retirement. And they need to be replaced. The problem is that many people don't come to nursing education right out of school. So they have worked clinically for a while, then they come. And a lot of times people are ready to stay in nursing and nursing education and continue to teach to impact practice in that fashion. The numbers if we were to look at different colleges and universities throughout the state, almost all of them have openings. Very few have full staff. Okay. Many places, such as Portland Community College, our institution, Linfield, other places have multiple positions okay. open.
One last question for me anyway. So the teachers at a community college or their nurse educators, are they on, is everybody on a common salary schedule? So the nurse educator makes the same as the welding instructor, as the history teacher, or they, it's all the same pay?
That is unfortunately true.
And is there a way to work around that or enhance their pay in some way according to, or is that a union contract issue?
For the most part, those may be collective bargaining or association contracts within that college.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate this. And Ann Ness and Mike Solomon, if you'd like to join us.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Pulp and Paper Workers. I almost forgot. It's like alphabet soup. I'm here, and AWPPW supports this because our plants, save one, and we have so few where our members work now, are in rural areas, and rural health is much more acute than it is in the major cities. I am married to a nurse educator, and so it's a personal thing for us, but I'm going to bring out some points. The federal government will make $80 billion in the next decade on student loan debt. After 15 years of endless war, I think, and almost at $3 trillion, perhaps the government makes money on student loans for that reason. I don't know. You can't discharge a student loan debt easily, although the banks can do it very well. I believe that we're making indentured slaves out of our students with this loan. It fits the definition. A two-year RN makes approximately one-third less than a graduating, or a two-year graduating RN will make one-third more than a nurse instructor upon graduation. The Accreditation Commission for Education and Nursing, ACEN, mandates that nursing instructors have a master's in nursing, but is now contemplating removing that requirement due to the shortage of faculty. Now, in the case of my wife, she had 30 years experience as a critical care nurse, set up all the education at Willamette Valley Hospital, and she couldn't be grandfathered in. She spent 18 months online every day, plus starting a new job as a student, you know, nurse educator. And I remember this very well because I had to do all the cooking, all the dishes. It was a long 18 months. My wife received no financial assistance from Chemeketa at all to achieve this master's degree. I happen to think, and I know it because I live with a nurse, it's a special calling. It's a public service. I don't think the nurse educators should be personally taxed. This is a public policy nightmare that isn't going to go away. I'm above 57 or 56, whatever the average age of a nurse is. Good luck to everybody younger than me. It doesn't look real good. We have a shortage of all kinds of skills in Oregon. They'll come from somewhere else, including nurses. We need to fix this problem. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, my name is Ann Nessie, and I represent Tax Fairness Oregon, and I think all of you have asked some excellent questions. I am a nurse, former nurse myself. I have several members of my family that have recently got master's degrees and doctorate degrees, and they all did it while working, so they actually didn't really accrue that much debt. As you saw, the salary is pretty good, especially if you're compared to average female salaries. A nurse makes a goodly amount. Even when you're working part-time, you can pay. pay for the education to get the master's. But your temptation is always to do the nurse practitioner because you get more money. But if you and when you get your master's, if you work in a federally qualified clinic, they also pay your debt. So some of the bills you're looking at are confusing because you do get federal money. In fact, my daughter told me the federal loans were better than Oregon could ever give. So I feel like I'm talking against my alma mater, but there are ways to repay their debt. At least I know from experience in talking to nurses that they want to teach maybe later in their career, after they've kind of done a lot. But even that they can repay because they're doing it for the joy of teaching then. And I'm not sure that this $350,000 will really help if you really look at the federal programs that there probably are for getting. And you can also get a doctorate via distance, because right now the doctorates are really kind of they're not described well. They don't necessarily get you to a higher clinical level of understanding of a patient. If I were to see you as a patient, it's not like me being an MD. They're more like research oriented. So that's why they do them by distance, and why they end up being, you can do them at a reasonable rate while you're working without a loan. That's my service.
Right. Yeah. Question to this panel? Rep. Alonzo Leon?
It's not so much a question, but I would thank you for both of your presentations. And I would say that we do have, I think, a problem with student loans in Oregon, right? We have a lot of student debt, a lot of students who work very hard. Not everybody can work and study. Not everyone can qualify or win all the scholarships available out there. I think this bill is a good bill in being able to help, certain students who aspire to be instructors, because we're in huge need of instructors. We've gotten a lot of people who have come up to us and shared that very concern, considering we have a nursing shortage, and particularly with instructors. And I always say, if you have specific information on scholarships or ways for people to get their loans,
there are ways.
Paid.
There are ways,
but not everybody knows about all of them.
They could probably be better advertised for sure.
but even then, I think there's still issues with that. Yeah. But I appreciate both of your presentations.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else care to testify on this bill? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2862. I think you're up next. Which one we're at? Let's see, OER one. Is that the OER one? Or, okay, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2729. And Laura, could you remind us of what this bill is about?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2729 would direct the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to work with public universities and community colleges to analyze and evaluate the effectiveness of adopted open educational resources and increase the number of OERs used in post-secondary courses. There is a -1 amendment posted on OLIS. It creates a name for the program, Oregon's Open Educational Resources Program, specifies the increased number of open educational resources be used in courses at public universities and community colleges and be transferable between public universities and community colleges. It changes the appropriation from $700,000 to a blank appropriation for the purposes of hiring open educational research specialists and for carrying out the program. The bill does have a fiscal impact, and there is a subsequent committee referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay. And I think, Rep. Wisnett, you're going to give us a little update on all the exciting things that have been happening.
And Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and honorable committee members, thank you for hearing the -1 testimony. We amended the bill, which we originally heard February 23rd, on a bill. I should be setting up there because this is a bill that all members of this committee are chief sponsors. So it's your bill. I hope you'll vote yes on this amendment and send it to the Joint Ways and Means. Creating the Oregon Open Education Resource Program in 2005 with the bill, House Bill 2871, a committee bill out of this committee, was a major successful accomplishment for the House Higher Education Committee and the 78th Legislative Assembly. 15 open education resource free online textbooks were adopted for use by Oregon college students, and the estimated value of savings for students was $2.1 million. I think that's per school year. The problem with the 2015 bill is it had a sunset because we did not have any direction or policy about continuing the program. So that's why we introduced this committee with individuals submitted 2729. I worked with the HEC, and other stakeholders gave me suggestions and everything. And so the new Dash 1 amendment adds a request that HEC establish an OER position to keep the program active for the future. The job description is outlined, but the HEC can create the job description. Also, the Dash 1 amendment asks for an undetermined amount of funds to adopt more OER textbooks. The 2015 bill authorized $700,000 and produced 15 textbooks. With this bill, we'll be asking the co-chairs for funding to do more unspecific textbooks because we need to finish up the ones we started this year and evaluate those. And then I hope that the chairs will put enough money into at least do 5 up to 10 more textbooks, but we'll see how it works out. So questions of the committee, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? This is something we've been, Rep. Johnson.
Good, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Honorable. Yeah, appreciate working with you on this. I think it's really, really important work. So maybe just summarize, if you could, again, for the committee, kind of the progress we've made over the last couple biennia, because this has been a two biennia effort for this committee. So we started in one place, but we've made some progress, right?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, thank you very much. Yeah, that was the main thing. I think I mentioned in the previous testimony that Tobias Reed, his last interim committee meeting, which he wasn't at, he says, Gene, we need to do something because we don't have a continuation of the program. And you've got to realize everyone here, I think, has some college or went to college, and trying to get deans and professors and administrators together to agree that this textbook is acceptable, you don't need to buy mine or buy one that I'm getting endorsements from or something like that. So it was a big effort to get that put together. I was appointed to the task force, and I attended the first few meetings to be sure they understood the intent of this committee, as we wanted free online. Like Representative Johnson and some of you, I think, have been approached by Chemeketa. They have a program where they're reproducing textbooks at a greatly reduced price. And I think that's important, but we didn't want to put these two together because especially the funding and the Ways and Means process. I think that bill we should continue to look at. I don't know if Representative Johnson did put anything in. But again, the main thing is once you get this structure, and this bill, by creating a LURC position, will have someone with that title to look after and push this program, go out, talk to students and see how it's going and things like that, which they've already been doing a little bit, and how other colleges would keep them together. So I think it's a thing of the future, technology online, and we know that it really does save students money. And it also helps the professors, I think, because you're not using a 5-year-old or 10-year-old textbook, and the professor can go in, and because every one of these textbooks had permission to go in and alter it, just put updated information or notes from them. So, and that was a lot of work by a lot of professionals, and I didn't participate in all those meetings, but I know it was difficult. And I think, again, I don't have the list with me, but I think we actually have more than 15, because like one textbook was like algebra 1, 2, 3. So it's really 3 textbooks for the one course, same textbook. So I hope that's good, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson.
That's great, and we really appreciate all of your work on this. Rep. Wisman has been a real champion of this, and the students I've talked to about it said it is something that's definitely made a big difference in helping them afford to go to school. So thank you.
I think Mr. Chair, too, comment. Remember, I think they testified that universities are now, they have to put on their list of courses that free online textbooks are available. So thank you.
So I would have no further.
Quick question. Did you say, so in order, it doesn't have to serve both the university, like in order for HEC to oversee this, it doesn't have to be for the higher university and the community college, but in the best, that's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
That it's, okay.
Well, yeah, mostly going to be lower level community colleges.
Most, but it doesn't, it's not required that they vote, that it has to, yeah, that's what I just want to make sure.
Certainly like to have a motion.
Okay, yeah. Chair Reardon, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated 3/23/2017.
And Rep. Alonso León moves to adopt the -1 amendment dated 3/23/2017. Any discussion? If no objections, no discussion, the amendment is adopted. You're on.
Chair Reardon, I move HB 2729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill will be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Rep. Alonso León moves House Bill 2729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? No discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
Aye.
Representative Solnit?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alonso León?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisniak?
Aye.
Chair Reardon?
And I wanted to mention, Rep. Hurd is excused today for personal issue. Okay. And I would be an aye. Motion passes. Bill is sent as amended to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Excellent. Okay. So I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2729. And we are over here. Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2929. Laura, please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill.
Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2929 would address student loan debt with the following programs. Direct state treasurer to establish student loan refinancing guarantee pilot program. Permits the state treasurer to establish contract with financial institutions to establish a loss reserve account whereby a financial institution participating in the pilot program may submit reimbursement claim for a loss incurred from a refinancing loan default. Requires Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop and make available a loan counseling program to Oregon residents who graduated from post-secondary educational institution. Specifies counseling program as voluntary and is created as distinct and supplementary to mandatory loan counseling under federal law. Also provides credit to employers that provide education loan repayment assistance to employees. Establishes refundable credit against personal income taxes for contributions to Higher Education Savings Network account. And establishes tax credit to employers for amounts contributed to employee Higher Education Savings Network accounts. Finally, establishes subtraction from personal income taxes for amounts that taxpayer paid in student loan interest.
All right. Well, welcome to our committee. Rep. Rayfield going to join us at some point, or we're delighted to have you here.
Thank you, Chair Reardon. Thank you, Vice Chair Wisnett and Vice Chair Alonso León. My name is Tony Lapiz, and I work with Representative Rayfield. Sadly, he is unable to make it. He's wrapped up in some really fun things going on down in Rules Committee, so I'm here in his stead. I'm also joined by the Honorable Representative Power. So today we're going to talk to you briefly about House Bill 2929, which, as the rather extensive brief summary entails, that it is a very comprehensive bill. So to preface, I'll be going through kind of the surface level, 30,000 foot view of the bill, and we'll gladly take any detailed questions as we conclude later. So to begin with some of the problems with student debt, as I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, as student debt is obviously not a foreign discussion to this committee. As we've seen in the last two decades, student debt has been almost exponentially increasing, and without any new funding to higher education, with continual tuition increases, this problem isn't going to go away. So this is a problem that we need to address sooner rather than later, and that's what we're hoping this bill does. From this graphic, you can see the main takeaway is looking back to this period prior to the recession, the kind of the idea behind going to college and walking away with a high-paying job that allows you to earn more money was true. And what that led to was more home ownership and more economic viability for individuals that went to seek higher education. However, this isn't the case anymore. Now we're seeing that even if you do go to college and you do come out with a higher earning job, that old school of thought is no longer true. And the reason why we're seeing lower home ownership is because people are under such an economic burden of student debt, which is then preventing them from being able to move on in life and own homes, purchase other things that contribute to the economy, as we'll see in the next slide.
So some pretty stark figures before you. Currently in the United States, borrowers have about $1.3 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. That translates to 44.2 million Americans. And interestingly, a figure I didn't previously know, 63% of Oregonians have student debt. So there are a lot of different factors in life that are influenced by one's student debt load. I'm going to share with you my personal story. My parents are strong believers in the value of education. Our family experienced hardship along the way, however, when my mom became permanently disabled when I was very young. Money was always tight, but nonetheless, they encouraged me and my sisters to go to the best school that we could get into. Between financial aid and loans, I was able to graduate from a private college with a debt level of less than $25,000. I went on to become the first in my family to go to law school, but I began school a month before the recession hit. My wife couldn't find full-time teaching work, and I had to take out the full cost of law school tuition and living expenses and federal student loans. I graduated in May 2011 with just under $200,000 in student loan debt. My parents have never been able to financially assist me with law school. They couldn't afford the plane ticket to come see me graduate. Today, the interest rates on 17 of my 18 different federal student loans stand at above 7%. With the high interest on my principal balance that continued to accrue while I was in school and later capitalized and added to my principal, my total loan balance has grown by 25% since graduation. I've been paying monthly payments since that point. Between my and my wife's collective undergraduate and graduate student loan payments and my bar study loan payment, our total monthly student loan payment often comprises more than 25% of our take-home pay. I believe we're at a crossroads in our country. A 2016 Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce study found that 99% of post-recession jobs have gone to those with a college degree. If we want a more educated, fiscally stable, and skilled workforce in the United States, these dramatic costs cannot endure. While much is written about these substantial debt loads, not enough attention is paid to reforming the process of repayment. Outstanding student debt now totals some $1.3 trillion, but surprisingly, and I really want you guys to listen to this, it's an amazing figure, borrowers with the smallest debts are most likely to default. Of those borrowing under $5,000 for college, 34% end up in default. Defaults lead to wage garnishment and ruined credit, and now under the Trump administration, certain types of loan defaults could be hit with fees as high as 16%. Think about what our state could look like if Oregon had our own debt repayment program that allowed people to dig back out from underneath college debt or refinance their debt at more reasonable interest rates. Think, too, of how Oregonians could further support their local communities with those saved dollars. As an elected official in the city where some 75% of the high school students are on free or reduced lunch, and where 50% of my constituents at the high school level go on to community college, I ask you to stand up for those of us who need pathways to more affordable loans and vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel?
And now Tony will continue the presentation.
Somebody's going to explain the program at some point.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. I was just laying the foundation
there
for the problem.
Right.
You're going
we'll
go
to
okay,
the solution.
This is why
is
I care
out.
And why I'm here.
Yes.
I see.
So, as the lead-in to HB 2929, we have broken this down into three main components to really look at the issues of student debt being a full continuum, being before college, once you get out of college, as well as a repayment of your student loan debt. So to do this, we've implemented mainly three sections to address this, as you can see up here. Incentivizing early savings, improved loan education and counseling, and assisting student loan repayment. This is really the incentivizing early savings is to incentivize non-traditional students to have the opportunity to save for college. As you'll see in the following slide, which is also on OLIS, saving is much more financially responsible than taking out student debt. Secondly, improved student loan education and counseling. It's a really confusing system. I don't know if many of you or your kids have gone through the process of taking out student loans and figuring out how to pay it, when it's due. I'm going through it right now, and it's really confusing. And so implementing a system to better educate students on this process within this bill. And lastly, implementing some creative ways to assist with repayment that I'll get further into in just a second. So to look at the benefits of incentivizing early savings, if we look at the benefits of saving $113,000, within that you would gain in earnings approximately, based on some statistics I found, you would earn about $94,000 on top of that, totaling about $207,000, easily able to get you through a college education if you're able to save, and within incentivizing it makes it easier. However, if you were to borrow the same amount, you're having to pay out an additional $163,000 on top of what you borrowed, so you're actually paying back $276,000. So as you can see, you're paying back more than double what you could have saved.
What's your assumed period of time that you're paying that?
18 years. So from birth until you would roughly be starting college. So now for the components in which we incentivize early savings, we have four main components that address this issue. Firstly, incentivizing early savings with a refundable tax for individuals, capped at income levels. Secondly, we have what I consider a creative way to involve employers to pay into student loan saving plans of their employees. They could get a tax credit for that. Thirdly, we increase the amount of savings that are tax deductible from per filer to per individual, so that you can save per child that you have. And lastly, which I think is one of the most interesting components of the bill, is that we exempt college saving plans from being counted as an asset to allow you to still qualify for state services, so that you can still save and not be cut off from otherwise deemed essential benefits that you're receiving.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back to the last slide, please?
Yes.
Okay. Got a lot in this bill.
Yes.
Okay, so here we're talking about incentivizing early savings, and you're going to give a tax credit for employers. Is that employers or the parents?
Yes.
So an employer is going to be, your program would have, I work for Intel, and my kids coming up, who paid their employees' college savings plan?
Chair Reardon and Vice Chair Wilson.
I don't know. The credit unions, their banks are going to be. We're going to start now. Each company is going to have a banking facility and a banking role.
Personally, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wilson, I can't really speak to the exact specifics of how it would practically play out.
Taken away. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Continue.
Carry on.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm not comprehending this. I can understand the Oregon Savings College Savings Program increasing that, but I don't know how we're going to help my employee, for my son or my grandson, to save. That's getting into taking business away from private companies and credit unions. I'm a member of credit unions, so I just don't understand that. I'll defer, and we'll see how the whole program goes. But I think.
Chair, Representative Whitten, I don't think it's intended to take away business from a credit union, but if a employer wanted to pay into the plan, some employers will match your donations, for example,
to charitable organizations. Others will may provide a, you know, parking stipend as part of its benefit packages, or others.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And I think
I have another clarification. I actually misspoke, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair, wasn't it? It's actually so the account holder, so the college savings plan account holder, has to be the employee of the employer. So it actually doesn't extend to your children. So it would apply to folks that are working currently, say 16, 17, 18, and trying to save for college. Their employers could put into their college savings plan and receive a tax credit for it.
Okay, I apologize. Let's finish.
We'll circle back on that.
Perfect.
So the second component of improving college exit counseling, this is an area where we really wanted to address the confusing myriad of options that students have to face as they're exiting college. And we wanted to be able to partner with HEC to be able to administer this program and facilitate this learning program. However, with meeting with HEC, we were able to identify several obstacles of, one, non-pre-existing personnel and information that we had thought that they had and since learned that they didn't. So within the current budget situation and the cost that would be associated with implementing this entirely new program, moving forward, if this were to go to Ways and Means, this will likely be one of the components that we'll take out. However, we'd wanted to acknowledge the positive conversation that increasing student loan exit counseling can bring to students.
Dr. Johnson.
I didn't really have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw you waving back there.
No, just okay. My caller was tight.
All right. How does this, we have IDA programs that are in existence where somebody can save for college education or their future in a variety of ways. Is that tied into this in some way, or should it be? Or
sorry, Vice Chair, I'm unfamiliar with the acronym IDA.
Individual
Development Account.
Development Account.
Okay. I do not know if it's involved within
this. We can pursue that
later. Okay. So the last section of components of the bill is to assist in repayment. First, for assisting in repayment is allowing for a state tax deduction for interest payments. Second, allowing for employers to pay off their employees, not their families, their employees, student loan debts and receive a tax credit for that, which is 50% of what they've contributed, not to exceed $2,500. And lastly, we are hoping, again, similar to the education component, to be able to partner with the treasurer's office and have the treasurer's office work with financial institutions to enable a program which would allow students to refinance at lower interest rates. However, again, with some newly acquired information working with the treasurer's office, this appears to be a program that would, one, surmount to a significant fiscal, and within, again, the current budget situation, this would likely be another component that we will remove once it gets to Ways and Means. However, working with the treasurer's office, we've identified a potential solution for future sessions that hopefully I can meet in front of you again soon and present. So overall, with just the credits and incentivizing early savings components of the bill, we're looking at a fairly hefty fiscal of $75.6 million, which obviously within the current budget system is an unlikely ask. However, to briefly look, we've addressed this in the best way that we can by preparing for conversations down in Ways and Means and adjusted for different amounts of tax credits, different amounts of criterion ratings, as well as removing some components and adjusting it to fit within what you'll see as a $30 million plan, a $10 million plan, a $5 million plan, and a $0 million plan. So we're kind of starting out with the really generous Christmas present and then seeing what mom and dad can give us in the end. And that's all.
Rep. Solman, you had a question?
Thank you, Chair. Back a few slides, there was $2,500 provides tax credit for employers that make payments on their employees' student loans.
Yes.
I was just trying to figure on How do they select which employees they want to help pay on their loans?
Yes. So within the bill in section 11 through, I think 14? 11 through 12, there's sections where it's implementing an assessment program that I believe partners with HEC to establish how the selection process happens. It has to be done on a non-biased, non-income-based level so that it is across the board and equitable for every employee.
Thank you.
And Vice Chair Wisnett, you had a question?
No, sir. That's sort of like the IDA.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. In Section 9, you talk about the HEC, Parent Education Coordinating Commission, shall develop and make available, blah, 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 a counseling program, basically, right? It's counseling that the resident may volunteer to attend and so forth. Have you talked to the HEC about this, whether they're comfortable being in that role? Because that's not really a role that they typically find themselves in, with being the intermediary between students, their lending institution, and so forth. It would be a new role for them, I'm pretty sure.
As Chair Reardon and Representative Johnson, that was why I was mentioning that in meeting with HEC and learning that this isn't actually a role that they fulfill anymore. Previous, I believe it was in 2005, they did have loan officers, and they would have had the capacity to better execute this new program. However, with that program no longer in existence, and I believe HEC is also here to testify, and they will probably speak to this better, but that's why likely this would be a program that we would remove due to the cost that it would be associated with.
It would have been somebody else in 2005, not the HEC. But second point is that you're probably aware that there are other legislative efforts to do some similar things on terms of deducting or using your interest paid as a credit on your taxes and so forth. I've got a bill that would do that, and then I know my senator has a bill that, along with Senator Courtney, I saw that just signed on today too, that's not only the interest but the principal paid as well within a given year would be a deduction off of your personal income tax as well. So there are other efforts to try to do some of these various components. So I think you're on the right track with some of these, and maybe there would be ways to, you know, partner on some of this and try to get at least some components of this through. And obviously anything that would come out of here that would have to do with taxes and credits is probably going to have to go through a revenue committee. And I see there's a subsequent referral in this bill as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No other questions? Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate your being here. You brought a lot of us, given us a lot to think about. And we have a second panel on this bill. Michael Parker, State Treasury, Kyle Thomas from HEC, and Tim Cohen. And I don't see anybody else that would care to testify. Anybody else? And I see Kyle is not with us today. Okay. Good afternoon.
Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. I want to start out first by telling you I didn't give you the courtesy of going back and trying to review everything that this amendment modifies. A couple of things that just came up as the last question. As an employer, can I ask the question about student debt during an interview? The second thing, if an employee quits, does the employee have any obligation to the employer for any reimbursement at all? Now I'll get to my testimony. The first one is, I reviewed this particular bill, and I didn't understand very much of it. And of course, my background is in banking, and I could sign for the SBA guaranteeing loans and all that kind of stuff. The counseling, I'll just read through these real quick. One, are they going to talk about APR, which and including fees? Is there any comments about non-performing, the effect on the credit report, impact on other loans? Because they could have a loan outstanding that if they have a problem with their student loan, it could impact that. Why? This is a big one for me. Why doesn't the loss guarantee provide a reduction in interest rate from the financing institution? Because if they're not going to have to incur that amount of write-off, they should give you an increase in the interest rates.
A decrease.
Just real briefly, when I had a region, I had to get, I had to cover my loan loss of about 4%. If I got it cut down to 2, well, there's some that can be given to the student as a part of a rate reduction, interest rate reduction. I would want to know if the, what the bank experience would be on loan losses, what kind of collection activities will they do, and will they have the authority to move and do that without the state concurrence. So can they renegotiate a loan? Can they extend terms? Can they go into collections without bothering to tell anyone or get permission for it? A couple of things in general. Who receives it? What are the criteria that the bank will establish for approval? How long from graduation will that make a difference? 4, creditworthiness. Is that going to be under bank control? Because if they have the loan guarantee, who monitors or who controls the credit quality? Have they defaulted on other loans? So those were my questions, and hopefully, if nothing else, that you should look at what type of interest rate reduction can you get from the guarantee, because the institution's making money off of it.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen.
Sure. Michael?
Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 Savings Network. And I'm here to testify in support of the bill as it relates to the 529 network. So I'll keep my comments to those pieces. But just briefly before I start, I just wanted to give the committee an update on the College Savings Plan. As many of you may or may not know, we began in 2001, the College Savings Plan did. That first year, we ended up with $33 million in assets and about 10,000 accounts. And I'm happy to report at the end of last year, we're at $2.7 billion and about 175,000 accounts. So we've been growing fairly well over the last 15, 16 years. But a stat that I'm actually most proud of, now that we're actually a mature plan, nearly $230 million we distributed last year alone to pay for college expenses. So what's happening now is our contributions are way up, but our distributions are now way up as well, which is great. That's what the plan is supposed to do. So we're actually distributing those dollars every year to the tune of about $230 to $240 million per year. Just briefly, again, I'll speak to the 4 tenets that relate to college savings, the low-income tax credit, moving money from a per deduction, per return to a per beneficiary issue, allowing an employer tax credit for contributions, and then protecting low-income Oregonians who are receiving state benefits to put money into a college savings plan. And really the reason we see this as so important is because incentives actually work for college savings. We see around the country when we talk with our colleagues, the larger your incentives or the more your incentives, the more people are apt to save. And I just want to give you one example of that. Quickly, we have a promotion called Baby Grad Promotion, and it really simply is that through every year through January through March, if you have a baby, and you open a college savings plan account, and we will put a $25 seed amount into that account for that baby for that year. So just quickly, 2015 and 16, we had 1,500 accounts opened in this program. $2.2 million was invested. So we put $25 in, but other folks put additional money in. 96% of those accounts had additional contributions in them. So comes down to we leveraged about $38,000 of our marketing money into about $8.2 million into college savings. So what we're trying to do with a lot of these tax incentives and other things is to leverage smaller dollars to get bigger dollars into college savings plans. So that really is why we support these bills. That's just an example of that. We also work with a lot of folks information regarding what a college what a college degree might mean to you. There's been a lot of research done on college savings accounts being in someone's name, so just having the account. I spoke to Representative Johnson in the Revenue Committee about this a while ago. But what we're trying to do is get the account open. That's what a lot of these incentives really do. The employer tax credit, that's what that does. The $100 tax credit for low-income Oregon gets the account open. Because once the account is open and they're in the system, then we can educate those folks about putting more money in, what it means to get that college education. So I'll just give you a couple of statistics. Children with college savings accounts do better academically. Middle and high school students with a college savings account have higher math scores and are twice as likely to expect to go to college. That's what we want. We want them to expect to go. Whether they have the money or not, we want them to expect to go to college. Children with college savings accounts have greater college expectations. This is my favorite stat. Those with $500 saved in a college savings account are three times more likely to enroll in college and four times more likely to graduate. So what you see with these incentives is just getting the account open. Once the account is open, friends and family can contribute to those accounts. Even if you're a low-income Oregonian that can't put a ton of money in, there's incentives that maybe your church is doing or your community is doing. Getting the account open is the critical piece. So with the employer tax credit, for example, it's just another distribution network for us. So your employer offers $100 into a college savings account, that gets the account open for you. As an employee, you may not know about the college savings plan. So you come on board as an employee, you get information on health insurance and retirement, you get information on college savings. If they're willing to put that $100 in and get that $100 tax credit, it's a way to get that account open for you. Again, it's an incentive, it's a way to get the account open. So this is why we really like these incentive programs, because we're leveraging dollars into larger dollars. So I'll close with just another stat that I found recently. We've been working a lot with Kaiser Permanente, and they're actually putting a program together to distribute materials in their maternity wards for us. But they're actually telling us that they believe that their research shows that people with college degrees are actually more healthy and more likely to have a longer life because of that college savings or that college degree. So they're actually making it a tenet of theirs to say, we want to help kids and families get that college degree because it's a health issue. So we're working with them to actually get more information out into their maternity wards, into the hands of parents. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, or Representative Wisden, if you had other questions on the employer credit, I'd be happy to answer those.
Yeah, Rep. Schulman.
Thank you, Chair. Just for clarification, on this account, you had mentioned that the college savings provides this opportunity and it provides this healthier person who wants to continue their education. And I think it really helps put that focus and that drive and that motivation, because they know that they have that there, and they know that they can invest their dollars in a program if I want to be a nurse or if I want to be a teacher. But also, what happens to the folks that want to be an electrician or a plumber? We have the ability to utilize this money for a trade school. Is that correct?
Chair Reardon, Representative Solomon, that is exactly correct. It's not just for 2 years or 4 years of school. It is for accredited programs, 1 year programs at community colleges, getting that certificate to be a welder, to be an electrician, to be a plumber. Certainly, you can use assets in a college savings plan to get those, to get that education.
Great. I just think this is a fabulous idea, and I really think that as we're helping students develop that focus while they're in high school with their plan and their pathway, figuring out what they want to do and then start saving even earlier than that high school time, I think this is just a win-win for helping our students with that year 13. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony and the facts and everything. I'm having a tough time. I don't know if we could bring the slide, but there's only certain issues in the bill that you said you're supportive of. And the question about the employer, I was concerned about the employer. If the employer goes into your fund, that's different than having the employer set up his own sort of fund operation and things like that. And I think it's a good program, and I concur that you need to start people earlier saving money and doing things like that. Could you give me, refresh my memory, did we provide seed money for this program? Have we returned that? What is your overhead expense for this program? And you do a lot of ads. Is that public service ads? Do we get that free? Those are a couple of questions. Thank you.
Sure. Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnett, we our the College Savings Network budget is right about, I would say, about $6 million a biennium, give or take. We did, way back in 2000 and 2001, borrow money from the legislature to start the program. Started with zero assets, so we had to have some money to do it. That money was all repaid before the five-year period ran. So now we run basically on, we're self-supported. We run on fees.
That's awesome.
and other money provided by our program managers. So the ads that you see on TV or anywhere else, those are not public service announcements. Those are paid for by the network. We have a budget that pays for advertising. The reason we advertise, obviously, is to get more people into the program. Mm-hmm. More assets into the program, more accounts means lower fees for everyone. But those are not public service announcements because we do way too many of them to actually qualify to get a PSA, which would be great. But, yes, we do pay for those ads on a rotating annual basis.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair? I think so. You have a ballpark administrative cost or whatever.
Sure. Chair Reardon, Representative Wisnett, the administrative cost to be in the program is about 22, so it's 0.22% on an annual basis, so 22 basis points annually is the administrative cost that you pay as a participant.
But
correct.
How much do you spend?
So we spend on marketing and promotion. That we spend in a given biennium anywhere from 2.8 to 3.2 million on a given biennium.
Percentage? We always look at percentage. Like admin costs should be less than 10% or something.
Yeah. Our administrative costs are again at 22 basis points annually, very, very low for a college savings plan. Our board and Treasurer Reed very interested in keeping fees low. Only way you're going to get assets up is to have a good plan, good investments at low fees. So we do that. We continue to work on our program managers to make sure that fees are continually going down. In fact, about 4 years ago, we cut our administrative costs the state takes in half because our assets were so high that we're not a for-profit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, we weren't planning on a review of the 529 plan. Glad to have it.
I do wherever I go. So.
And I will put in a plug for all the grandparents in the room. It's a great feeling to see that account building up for your grandkid.
It is. Thank you.
And it really makes shopping at Christmas easier because then you feel like, hey, I've got it done. So mm-hmm. I'm just saying. Okay.
Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you very much.
Can I do that and my grandson go to North Carolina, not Dory?
I stopped some orders at your car.
For no other questions, Rep.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Mr. Thomas. And this was short, right?
Yes, Chair Reardon.
I always do that, too.
I promise it will be short. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Given the comments of Tony at the opening of this public hearing, yes, I can, in fact, be short. Just as it pertains to Section 9 of the bill, just to point out that the HEC does not operate or have any involvement in any student loan programs, and the reference previous was correct. The last time, it was then the office, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission had involvement with the student loan program, was back in 2005. That commission has now been absorbed into the HEC as our Office of Student Access and Completion. It does maintain a few accounts dating back to the 90s for individuals that have not yet paid off loans offered in those programs. But other than that, there is no infrastructure or expertise within the HEC to do this work. An additional practical consideration to keep in mind when considering this legislation is that because the HEC does not service federal loans, it does not have access to the National Student Clearinghouse, which is the database by which we would gain the information required to do the activities envisioned under Section 9. And because we don't have a valid federal purpose for having access, it's unclear whether or not we could acquire that access. So it does create a perhaps insurmountable challenge in implementing the legislation. Again, just briefly on Section 11, I would extend the my remarks about expertise and infrastructure to that section as well. That is the section that envisions HEC certifying employers that offer a student loan repayment as a employee benefit. Having HEC certify those employers as being eligible to offer that benefit and gaining a state tax benefit for doing so. certainly because it's student loan related, that it seems natural for that to fall in the HEC's responsibility. However, the topic is really certifying the eligibility of employers for estate tax purpose, and that probably carries with it the necessity to have expertise in other areas of state or federal tax law that are not currently housed within the HEC. So I would ask the committee if they consider that piece to perhaps consider alternatives to doing that certification. And I'll end my testimony there and just see if there are any questions.
And we will definitely consider that. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you, Kyle. Anyone else from the public that would like to testify? Excellent. Closing public hearing on House Bill 2929. We are. Okay. We're here, right? Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2864. Be advised, we're likely to be working this one as well, so despite the lateness of the day, be alert. Laura, would you please provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, as written, House Bill 2864 would require each public university and community college to establish a cultural competency oversight committee. There is a -3 amendment posted on OLIS that replaces the measure. It directs each public institution to establish its own process for cultural competency standards, recommendation, implementation, and oversight, and specifies process requirements. A fiscal impact statement has been issued. There's no revenue impact and no subsequent committee referral.
Okay, great. And I'm going to invite people to just come on individually. Krista Stearns, would you like to lead off, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Krista Stearns, and I'm an assistant general counsel for Portland State University. I appreciate the committee taking the time to listen to Portland State University's concerns and comments today. And I'd especially like to thank the Oregon Student Association and Representative Alonzo Leon for working with us and working with the state's public universities to make changes to the bill in the -3 version to address some of those concerns. Portland State University and the other public universities are deeply committed to the goals underlying this bill. It's very important to just our way of being. And at PSU in particular, inclusion and diversity are implemented and embedded throughout our strategic plan, including our strategic goal number 4, which is to expand our commitment to equity. It's a very sort of self-conscious approach to these issues. But even more importantly, PSU has committed time and resources to making our campus a welcoming and inclusive place. Although there is still much work to do, and we recognize that. For instance, we implemented a diversity action plan for the first time in 2012, and we also have something that's known as the Diversity Action Council. It's a fairly large council committee made up of faculty, staff, and students, and they do some really incredible work. Its role is to foster equity and social justice by reviewing PSU programs, policies, and decision-making, and developing recommendations that aid the university in working to serve the best interests of our diverse and multicultural communities. It seeks to break down barriers, challenge stereotypes, and celebrate the differences that we have within our community and in the wider community of the Portland metro area. One of the projects that I think is most interesting, just to sort of highlight for you the kind of work they do, is the annual series of cultural competence workshops. This year, for instance, that series or symposium includes a workshop on universal design, finding connection and access through culture, and discussing cultural terms like from cultural competency to cultural humility and the meaning of those different terms. That series culminates in a day-long symposium and workshop on cultural responsiveness, which is set for May of this year. It's important that the work of the committed individuals who are involved in this existing process and others within our university and the other public universities is acknowledged and supported. And we want to make sure that the bill does not have an unintended consequence of displacing those existing programs and the frameworks that are already functioning well. So we're grateful for the willingness to work with us in an effort to make the language less prescriptive and to allow for a variety of approaches, so long as that process is, in fact, inclusive, includes all stakeholders, including staff, and, of course, students is an important participant in that process. So while we understand that our existing framework may need to be modified, it's critical that each institution is able to implement the bill in a manner that's consistent with its culture, respectful of ongoing work in the area, and is effective at creating and supporting a welcoming and inclusive campus. Along those lines, we have two, I'd say, main concerns that exist with the Dash 3 version. The first is found at page 2, line 2, in the concept of oversight. And from a lawyer's perspective, I think we're just sort of unsure about how that oversight process would work. It has sort of a semi-regulatory tone. And, you know, as a working idea, I think that perhaps something like advice on versus oversight might be a term that might better work within those existing frameworks is one idea. The second concern that remains is on page 2, line 7, of the concept of equal weight of the stakeholders that are involved. And, you know, is that, for instance, a, you know, one person, one vote, equal number of students, equal number of faculty, equal number of staff, or is it more of a commitment to, you know, listen hard and take all stakeholders' input on an equal basis? And so we think that there's some lack of clarity there that might make implementation a little more difficult. So with those comments, I know it's late in the day, and I appreciate your attention and thoughts. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Alonzo Leon's office and the OSA to address these concerns. And I want to thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions if you have any.
Okay. Do we have any questions?
Oh. I just have one.
Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming. And I guess my question is, how do you know when somebody's culturally fluent in the sense that how do you know they've had enough training or they don't have enough training? What are the metrics? Or as an employer, let's say I'm an employer at the community college, how can I tell one of my employees isn't meeting this criteria, and then what do we do about it?
Representative Rushke, through the Chair Reardon, I'm probably not the best person to ask that question. I'm just the attorney. But, I mean, we have at PSU, for instance, an Office of Global Diversity and Inclusion that takes complaints from people who feel that they've been treated improperly. So one metric would be whether somebody's perhaps had complaints against them, I suppose. I certainly hope that we don't have to wait to a complaint process before trying to evaluate that. The professionals that work in that area each day, I think, are probably better suited to discuss those metrics. But I think we do look through the process of developing sort of the strategic plan and our diversity action plan. I do think that there are metrics out there that we'll look at student success. You know, are students succeeding in graduating? Are our diverse students succeeding in participating at different levels than other students? So I think that there are metrics out there, but I probably can't speak to exactly how that would be evaluated.
Okay. Thank you.
And did I understand this correctly that each campus will actually develop their own criteria for measuring?
Yeah, I think that that's probably right. And that would acknowledge, I think, the diverse nature of each of the colleges. You know, when I think of that, I'm speaking of sort of the larger public universities, but they do have distinct cultures and missions. Portland State University is an urban university. I think about over 25% of our student body, and maybe even larger, is considered culturally diverse, if you will. That may be very different from Western, and they may have also different subsets. We have a large group of international students that might dictate how we might evaluate success differently than a university that has a lower percentage.
Okay, great. Yeah. Vice Chair Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you speaking for PSU or for all the universities?
I am not authorized to speak for all the universities. I would represent that I think that my comments would embody some discussion that have been had between the Council for the Universities. Representative was not through Chair Reardon. Sorry about that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
But here I am today just for PSU.
Thank you for those comments. I've been on this committee as long as Representative Johnson. He was on the subcommittee for longer than me. But we all agree that this is an issue that needs to be addressed by our administrators and our presidents. I think last session when we talked about this, and I can't believe in today's society that we don't have an office, we don't have a staff, we don't have a established organization to address these issues within our university systems. I took your comment right off the bat. Your comment is you don't want to eliminate anything that's working, and I don't see that still in the bill. I hope the good representative understands. I'm totally saying we must have this. We must, in today's society, we must world as we must have this. I'm not sure that the universities, some universities are not doing it, and I want to be holding those universities that are not doing it responsible for doing it. I know that, you know, we lay on a lot of requirements to universities, and that costs money, which is translated in increased tuition. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to do anything to increase tuition more than necessary. I do believe completely in safety of our students. That's got to be provided. They're not going to learn if they're not in a safe environment, and that their concerns are not heard by the leadership. I think this is a lot better bill than the original bill, as you talked about. The oversight is another concern I have. What that means? What is oversight? You punish them? You put them in jail? You cut their arms? What that means? So, you know, I'm going to think about the bill. I'm going to look at the bill. I think everyone up here agrees we need to have this within our university system. But what is it, and why, if some universities are doing it, why do we have to tell them to do anything? Just keep doing your job. And I don't know if I can get it in time for the when the chair plans to move this, but I'd like to know what's the staffing? How many FTEs do the universities have that they're addressing this issue now? And why aren't they doing a better job if the students aren't happy or don't feel secure? So those are some comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Question, it'll come back right after you sit down.
I'm here for the duration, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Well, we have other guests today, so maybe it'll come up. So thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you all.
Mr. Gilbert. And Rep. Alonzo Leon.
Is the fiscal out on this? I can't find it. Is the fiscal out on this?
There is. I can send it.
Okay, I can see it in the material.
Okay.
Either one. Mr. Gilbert.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I don't have prepared testimony, but I am available to answer questions.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Alonso Leon, and I represent House District 22, which covers Woodburn through the north part of Salem. I'm testifying briefly today to clarify the intent of this bill. HB 2864 is intended to create an inclusive process by which universities and community colleges can create their own standards and goals for cultural competency. For universities and community colleges that already have the diversity and inclusion efforts in place, this process will be akin to a self-analysis of what is working and what is not working. The bill requires that in this self-analysis, the voices of students, staff and faculty and administrators will be heard, and that their perspectives will be given equal weight. We have worked with the universities throughout this process to ensure that the language in the -3 amendment allows for flexibility so that each institution can engage in creating these standards and goals in a way that works for their existing structure. The bill states that the process must be given equal weight to the perspectives of administrators, faculty members, staff, and students. That language provides flexibility. It allows for universities to meet this process in a number of ways, including as a work group or committee where participants are given votes, or a consensus approach where standards and goals are made in a collaborative process. Universities and community colleges are free to satisfy this requirement in whatever best way it fits their campus culture. Once again, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Rep. Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here today to talk about the bill. I'm curious, the language that Representative Alonso Leon mentioned about the equal weight part. I guess, Dan, this is a question maybe for you in your, I guess, legal opinion about the one voice, one vote process. Would that be able to be satisfied in other ways, like through a consensus?
Chair Reardon, Representative Bynum, in response to your question, I would agree with Representative Valenzuela Leon. Definitely the intent in that was conveyed to me and the intent when I was drafting it was to give the flexibility and to let it be done in a number of ways, including consensus. Consensus, one person, one vote is probably one of the most straightforward ways of complying with it. But I believe that there is flexibility there for several other approaches as well.
Thank you.
Follow-up? So I just want to be really clear. So one person, one vote. I see people sitting around a nice table. They're all having a good time. And everybody's equal on that table. Is that's what your expectation is?
Chair Reardon, that is not what I was intending to say. My intent was to say, if that was the approach that the institution chose to adopt, that I think that would comport with the requirements of the bill, but that there could also just be people sitting around trying to reach consensus. I would hope that there would be other ways that they could come around and have things that, I'm blanking on her name, but the previous person who testified was saying that everyone's voices listened to seriously. And I think the key here is that any decision would be based not on the status of any of these, of them being a member of one of these four groups, but that rather it would have to be more of a, based on the content. But I believe there is significant flexibility within the bill, and that is definitely the intent.
So the flexibility, and who gets to do the flexing?
Each institution decides on the process they would like.
Who specifically within the institution sitting around this table makes a decision about the degree of flexibility and the weightedness of the decision-making process?
Chair Reardon, that would have to be determined. Right now, what the bill does is it says each public institution of higher education shall establish a process. It would have to be designed within that process that process should set that forth.
So there's a, okay. Not necessarily this group. There's another process. Could be the
that establishes the group and sets up the rules for the
group. That's what I'm trying to get clarified.
Okay. Correct.
So, okay.
Chair Reardon, if I can add to that, if an institution already has in place a group that focuses on these issues, that group needs to do a self-analysis and make sure that they have representation of all the voices, including students, faculty, administrators, everybody. So essentially, whatever decision they make as a group, as a whole, essentially all of their voices would be equally represented or equally weighted based on their own infrastructure.
Okay, I'm going to try one more time. I just want to be, this seems to be so important to everybody. It seems like shouldn't be that hard, but just in case. So we're at some institution, let's say, PSU, for example, and they want to form this group to work on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Who identifies the people that are going to be in the group? What specifically at Portland State, for example, who would configure this group and identify the members that are going to participate? I'm trying to be abundantly clear, just in case it goes to some discussions in one other end of the building.
Sure. Chair Reardon, I'm going to try to explain this.
Okay.
So we know that PSU already has an office of diversity and inclusion.
Okay.
Essentially, if they already have something, an infrastructure, they could be the body that does this work. But they also need to make sure that if they're missing the student voice, that they include the student voice. If they're missing the faculty voice, that they need to make sure they have the faculty voice.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Representative?
Good, Representative. I want to help you. That's not what the bill says, Mr. Gilbert. It doesn't say that if you have a program going on that you just have to tweak it or something like that. Also, you look at a bill and you want to know what's the bill, what's it requiring? And the bill says that we're going to requiring them to prepare a biennium report, that is presented to the board regarding the institution's progress towards achieving the goals set forth in this subsection. So it's the local board. We don't define which board it is. Is that
Chair Reardon, Representative Wisnan, boards defined in Section 1.
Okay, so I haven't engrossed it. I'm sorry. This just came today, and I have not.
I'm sorry. So it's within the -3 amendments as well on the first page.
Okay.
Institutional board or the college board.
Okay. Let me see 1 minute, Mr. Chair. So again, so then the recommendations are all within the institution. It's not going to come back to this body or to the legislature because it's going to be, I don't see anything where it says come back and tell the legislature you're passing or failing or you're not doing a good job.
Chair Reardon, Representative Wisnan, that's correct.
Follow-up, one follow-up, and I'll quit.
No, please.
I still don't understand or see where the bill says, if you're doing good, God bless you, go on and do your thing. I don't see that in the bill.
Chair Reardon, Representative Wisnett, the intent of the bill is for universities and community colleges to do a self-analysis. They will determine, and this is part of the work they're going to be doing, where they're at. They're going to see what's working and what's not working in respect to their own institution. They will determine what are the areas that they need to work on, so for self-improvement.
Thank you. I apologize. But no. So there's no revenue impact? There's no universities going to eat this out of their hide? They're not going to raise tuition to do this?
Move clarification on revenue on the fiscal on this.
Yeah, specifically, Chair and members of the committee, there's no revenue impact statement, but there has been a fiscal impact statement issued. The Joint Ways and Means Committee hasn't per se requested this bill, and fiscal hasn't indicated that it should go to Joint Ways and Means, but there is a cost impact that the public universities and public community colleges have indicated is needed. It's just been posted on OLIS since it was submitted. And so it's available to you.
Mr. Chair,
what is it?
My comment is I don't want to pass this if it's going to cause the institutions to raise their tuition. As a taxpayer, I'd want to go out to those universities and say, why are you not doing this? You got all this money and you're not doing it. So it's not that I don't want it done, but this bill requires the universities to say we need more money or more staff, then I'm not sure that because you're saying it's going to be done internal, it's not we're not going to go check them out or see if they're right. They're just policing them on their own self. Is that the intent of the bill?
Representative Reardon, Rep. Wisnant, I want to recognize that many institutions are already taking strides to create a culturally inclusive atmosphere, as you have heard. The bill is simply intended for institutions to engage in self-analysis, as I mentioned, hearing from students, staff, faculty, and administrators on what can be done to increase cultural competency. The bill was specifically crafted to allow flexibility so that this effort can be weaved into the existing infrastructure within institutions with minimal burden and costs.
Is that in Section 1?
I want to take a recess.
Is that in Section 1?
We'll take a recess. Yeah. We'll be back. Can we talk for a second?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll come back to order. We've got some questions on the bill, and this is too important of a bill not to get it right. I think there's still some additional work that can be done, and I'm concerned personally about the costs that are showing up on the fiscal. I want to pass this bill, but we need to get it right. And this is a super committee. We've been working super well together. I want to keep doing that to get something that's right for the universities, for the community colleges, and mainly for the kids. So with that in mind, we're going to carry this over till the next committee on March 30th. And so what do we do? Hit the gavel on that one. And then I think it's time to go home. I'm closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development. Time to go home. I'm closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed.